Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. We are live without a net. It is Monday, May 21st, and I have the pleasure of being joined by our managing editor, Ed Harrison. Ed, how are you doing?
Good. You know, you said May 21st. I believe, looking at my watch, it's May 24th, in fact.
Oh, wow. You're correcting me already.
You're thinking about Friday. You're still, you know, living, getting ready for the weekend.
Yeah, exactly. My mistake. It is the 24th. Today is Monday. And Ed, you know, there's days like, let's say, last Wednesday when the crypto market was tanking, where you just have to, so much to cover. And then there are days like today where there's so many interesting stories, but nothing really stands out as something, you know, that we have to cover right now because it's so timely. So, Ed, today, you and I were chatting. I want to use today as to sort of zoom out and just give people a framework of where we are in the market. So real quick, I'll say, Ed, you know, the stocks were, they performed well today. They drifted higher. NASDAQ up about 1.4%, S&P up 1.17%, and the Dow up just over 0.5%. But Ed, what interested me was that the headlines today was that tech stocks surge as inflation fears ease, which is typical what you see when tech stocks surge. But I actually looked at the inflation breakevens, which is what the market, you know, how the market measures inflation fears, because it's what the market prices future inflation will be. And inflation breakevens actually rose today.
Yeah, which is interesting. You know, so this whole as, and, you know, just for everyone who's listening, they as we consider to be, a shorthand way of saying because. You don't want to say because, but so you put as there to give you an out. But this is a case where you've been caught red-handed going as when really there is no as. It's exactly the opposite. If I had to put an as there, Jack, I'd put it probably to the crypto market, to be honest. I think that, you know, it's a risk on again. And, you know, that goes from crypto to the NASDAQ, to the S&P, to the Dow in reverse order. And that's how I would look at it.
Yeah. And then there's also the factor of China, which, you know, there was some big news out of China today. They cracked down on speculation, not in the crypto market, but in the commodity market. And here I'm reading, China stepped up its fight against soaring commodity prices and announcing that it will show zero tolerance for monopoly behavior and hoarding. And on the news, Ed, iron and steel ore dropped 6%. They recovered later, but it shows that China, it's not just that they're cracking down on crypto speculation, they're cracking down on commodities as well.
Yeah, you know, I think that this is a good way for us to move beyond crypto here today and to talk about what's in the market. You know, I will put the crypto in the back of our heads because obviously China's dealing with crypto. But let's start with other markets. You already talked about the commodities markets. Just a generalized context. The way that I'm thinking about it is that we have a shift that's happened. The Chinese have wanted it to happen for some time. That is they're looking to go to a consumer-oriented economy. They want to get rid of the debt-laden, export-led, infrastructure-led economy that they used to have. And the aftermath of the pandemic gives them a chance to be able to do that. So when they downshifted their growth as a result of the pandemic, that meant that they had an out to stop going after these ambitious growth targets. And so now what they're looking to do is to move in a new direction. And part of doing that is to rein in excess, to really, you know, wring out all of the excess debt, the speculative behavior that is concomitant with that debt, and What we're seeing, therefore, is a regulatory push across a lot of different things. I think you and I, we were looking at a story that was in Bloomberg about this bad bank, Huarong Asset Management, where the previous head had actually been executed for not doing the right thing. That's not the sort of thing that happens in the West if you run a bad bank. But, you know, the whole story was about the new head of the bank and how this new head was getting his arms around the problem of the bad debt on the balance sheet.
Absolutely. And that bank is called Huarong Asset Management. And it really is brewing to be quite a scandal because this bank was started, I think, in the late 90s to serve as an investor in distressed debt. And we in the West, when we hear that, we think of people like Howard Marks, people who are, you know, opportunistically, you know, deploying capital to yield an outsized return on investing in bonds that are trading significantly below their par value because everyone has lost faith in them. They are distressed. But actually, I think the goal of Huarong Asset Management pretty quickly, if not from the beginning, turned out to be essentially house the bad debt of the Chinese banking system. So it's not the People's Bank of China, which is the Chinese central bank. It's, you know, a few hundred meters away from the PBOC, People's Bank of China, in terms of the office, but it actually sort of serves this role that the Federal Reserve served after the great financial crisis of serving as a storehouse for toxic assets.
Yeah, and you know, it was a very interesting article that gave you a good glimpse into what's going on in China. There's a centralization of power under Xi, but at the same time, there's also this need to crack down. And I think that you saw another story of the same sort of thing in terms of the regulatory oversight increasing in the food market. Maybe you could talk about that.
Oh, in the food. Well, that was based on the same article about iron ore and steel, right? It basically was strongly disincentivizing speculation in the commodities markets for foods, whether it's pork, which is, you know, China consumes the most pork in the entire world, or other food products. Basically, asking people to speculate less in the market, essentially, and hoard less. They use that term, which is quite a judgmental term.
Yeah. And so what I would say is that gives you the sort of the backdrop. When we think of why the crypto market fell, there were two different things in crypto from the Chinese. They went out and they talked about speculation in the crypto market. And they also went against the crypto miners. And both those actions pick up a market that was already buffeted by some statements from Elon Musk and some regulatory action from the United States. But I think just from a wider context, think of it as the Chinese not necessarily targeting crypto. Perhaps they are from a digital currency perspective because they have their central bank digital currency that they're going to launch, but really more from regulatory, let's reduce bad debt, let's tamp down on speculation perspective. And so that's the big story for me in terms of, you know, macro things that are happening and how they're related to the crypto market.
Yeah, two quick things. One, really quickly, Ed, is just on the food angle. I think you can't just look at this from a financial point of view. It's not so much that they're worried that people are making too money speculating in food. It's that they're worried that that will rise the price of food, and that could, I think, contribute to social unrest and political instability. The second thing, Ed, is I want to run an idea by you, which is I was looking at Huarong Asset Management. I was looking at their bonds, and I expected the bonds to be issued through Huarong Asset Management, which is what it was called. But they actually have a variety of, I don't know if they're limited liability companies, but, you know, sort of shell entities that they issue them from. And they have, every single year, they have a different company. So there's like Huarong 2017. It's called Huarong Finance 2017, Huarong Finance 2018, 2019. And what I noticed, what really struck me, is that these bonds are issued through the holding companies, and the holding companies have what's called a keep well agreement or a comfort letter, where basically the parent organization guarantees, or wink, wink, you know, unofficially guarantees that the bond will be paid off. And that in turn attracts capital so they can secure it at a much lower rate. And I want to, you know, it, it did remind me of one thing, and I don't want to cause alarm and I don't want to make a comparison that's not apt, but in this case, I really do think it is apt, which is, you know, I've studied pretty closely the history of Enron, and I know specifically that they did this many times where they had an off-balance sheet arrangement where they, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, guaranteed the loan, and the loan was guaranteed by that stock, which is not the exact same thing. But I think it's a habit that you don't often see that's on the up and up. Now, do I think that borrowing, asset management, will they be subject to the same pressure as Enron? No, because I think that they are fully backed by the Chinese government. So I think that they have some serious ammo at their back. But it did strike me. So I wonder, Ed, do you think that I'm going too far? Do you think I'm being a little too dramatic?
You know, I don't know. I think, interestingly, when you started down that path, I thought to myself about Fannie and Freddie more than Enron. So the last part that you put about the implicit backstop from the federal government, that's really where I was thinking, because Fannie and Freddie, when they ran into trouble in 2008, what ended up happening is they got nationalized. And so... The implicit backstop was made good. Perhaps that's what would happen with Huarong, is that if they ran it aground, instead of being implicitly backed by Huarong, the holding company, it would actually be the PBOC or the government in some capacity coming in and making good on the debt. But that whole arrangement just tells you why. They have to tamp down on speculation, why they are doing what they're doing. They're really trying to, get a grip on the debt, which really went way up during this whole infrastructure-led growth phase that China went through.
Yeah, and just to give people at home context, I think there's about $41 billion worth of bonds that Huarong has issued that are, have to be paid off soon. Up until recently, the bonds were trading at par, meaning 100 cents on the dollar or $100 for every $100. One bond didn't pay a coupon payment in, sometime around March. I forget the exact date. And the bonds just plummeted. But then there was a regain of confidence. But over the past week, they've gone down again. So now they're trading at about 60 cents on the dollar. So, that is not a huge, well of confidence from the investors.
That is for sure. To go to the crypto market for one second, Jack, because we made some comments on Friday that I wanted to go back to. So crypto pretty much is round tripped. On Friday, we were talking, I think we were at probably the 38 level. Maybe we were already at the 40 level. And I was talking about support being in the 30 to 32 level. And so this is when the Chinese regulatory missives got in there. Suddenly the bottom fell out. And we just saw overnight, 10, 12, 15% losses to the point where it got to 31 and change. And then it bounced very nicely. Continued up to 36. And now I think we're almost back to the 40,000 level. But I think what it shows is that there is this, the 200-day moving average around the 40,000 level. The next level of support, as I was saying on Friday, 30 to 32, that's been proved right. We bounced off those levels and now we're back to that 200-day moving average level just below it. And so we'll just have to see where the crypto market goes from here. But for me, the amount of loss that we've seen, which is in the order of 30, 35, 40%, at one point, 50%, the question you have to ask yourself, have we seen the top of the market? And when I say, have we seen the top of the market, I'm not talking about crypto. I'm just talking about crypto as a manifestation of a wider trend. When you think of ARK Invest, when you think of the most speculative equities down 30, 35%, when you think about Tesla, which is well off its highs, you do have to wonder, are those shares coming back? Or are we seeing right now the beginning of a long-term sideways trend or correction / bear market?
Well, what does your gut say, Ed? Because we've been in a little bit of a sideways trend for bonds, for the higher quality speculative tech, so let's say Tesla, and I say higher quality to differentiate it from something like, let's say, Nikola, you know, that's been going down, but not as much as we saw, you know, in the real fireworks of late February, early March. You know, so Bitcoin, as you say today, staged a remarkable resurgence. I also noticed that Virgin Galactic was up a few bucks, something, you know, 15-20%. I don't know the exact number. So we are seeing a resurgence in that quite speculative technology. What does your gut say, Ed, about where we're going to be in, let's say, 3 months for crypto as well as these non-profitable growth companies?
Well, I think a lot of it depends on the real economy, but I can give you some of the parameters that I'm looking at. You know, I thought it was very interesting. I saw something that Lance Roberts, who is over at RIA Advisors, wrote. I'm good friends with his partner, Michael Leibowitz, who I've interviewed here in Real Vision twice. And, you know, he basically warned of a bubble in stocks back in March 2020, right before that bubble popped. And what he's saying is that shares are at their highest level ever relative to the 3-year moving average, you know, in terms of standard deviations. This is the highest ever. And it, I mean, that makes a lot of sense, given the fact that, you know, we've had a run of like 80 some percent up at one point in the NASDAQ. But he has some other metrics that he was looking at. You know, RIA's fear greed index is registering extreme greed right now. We see when we look at all the surveys, Bank of America, money manager surveys, other surveys showing extreme levels of bullishness amongst professional money managers. And then finally, I think Lance Roberts mentioned margin debt near highs with inflows into long leveraged ETFs relative to the short leveraged ETFs at extremes, which would suggest that everyone's bulled up, everyone's on one side of the trade. And when you see that, that makes the market vulnerable to a pullback. And even though the market's vulnerable to a pullback, it doesn't mean the pullback has to happen. If the real economy sticks with us, we can get through this. Let me add one more piece in before you give your analysis here. I saw something from John Authors that came out today, and he was talking about the Shiller PE ratio. The Shiller PE is now 37 times, which is the highest that it's been, except for a few months during the dot-com bubble in 1999-2000. So we're at extreme levels in many different places. And so that would suggest that we're vulnerable to a pullback. And to me, that means that, you know, how the real economy does is very important at this particular time.
Ed, yeah, that's a really interesting chart. One of us, you or I, could post this on Twitter later so people can see what we're looking at. But yeah, the price to earnings, the CAPE ratio, which is essentially, it's inflation adjusted, but it's also spread across multiple years. So you're not just capturing a snapshot in history, you're capturing multiple years. So that's that 37 price to earnings ratio, which, as you said, it's higher than any other time other than 2000. So that's the blue line. But Ed, what about this red line, which is long-term interest rates? I mean, in 2000, long-term interest rates were what, 6-7%? Now we're still, you know, barely hovering above zero. So isn't that going to make a difference? Because, you know, Ed, as you say, it's the DCF stupid.
Right. Yeah. So I think that a lot of people, they would hang their hat on the fact that, you know, the difference between then and now is that we've had a steady erosion of the interest rate. And so I think that explains some of the, you know, some of why you have an elevated PE ratio. But obviously what that would suggest is that interest rates aren't going up. And why would interest rates not go up? Well, because the economy is stagnant, or because the Fed isn't able to get off zero in the way that they weren't able to in 2018, 2019, when they were forced to backtrack, the famous Powell pivot. So there's something wrong with that. You know, when you have high PEs because you have low interest rates and they're rock bottom, either one of those two doesn't work. Either the price is too high because it's talking or because of the earnings, the PE, the earnings are going to be lower than you think that they're going to be, or you know, the interest rates are going to go up, in which case it's not justified by the discounted cash flow. It's the DCF stupid.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, I should add that it's not always the DCF stupid. Like, I think if you look at periods like the 1950s and 1960s, interest rates were pretty low, but the PE ratio was like 11, whereas now it's 37. So of course there's things like debt, there's things like demographic, cyclical things, and so many more things. But generally, the lower the interest rate, the higher the price to earnings ratio is, because the lower the rate from which you're going to discount those future cash flows. So if E is constant, then P has to go up. But Ed, my question is, what if E, meaning earnings, and that's the denominator, the price is P, which is the numerator. What if E just continues to outperform our wildest dreams, like it did during earnings season with Apple, with Netflix, all of these companies reporting spectacular earnings? And Ed, I might add, what if that 37 actually goes down because you have the FANG stocks whose earnings are continue to grow, but they've continued to be trapped in a holding pattern in terms of their price? And then the companies who are growing, the price their companies are going up, like ExxonMobil, it's because they went from losing $7 billion a year to gaining $12 billion a year. So it actually is, priced in. What do you think? What do you think about that?
Well, what I said before with regard to, the earnings potentially not being as good in an economy where the interest rates are low, really, you can't get over that by changing the composition, because when you're looking at the CAPE ratio, you're really looking at an aggregate ratio. And, that's much more representative of the economy as a whole, at least large cap companies. And so if the overall economy is stagnating, irrespective of whether or not, individual components are larger and they're doing well, you still have a bunch of other companies that aren't doing well, and you aggregate that all together, and you're never going to be able to keep the E portion growing higher unless the overall economy is growing higher. And so that's what we want to do. The question is what do we do at this particular juncture to prevent secular stagnation? So even if interest rates go up somewhat because we are, the economy is going better and the Fed gets off zero, earnings go up so much more just because, there's more oomph in the economy. That's sort of like the Goldilocks equation. And, I was thinking about this earlier today from the perspective of the house prices, because there was a tweet that was out that was talking about Iowa. And there was one specific example where this woman was talking about a house that was priced at $115,000. And 2 days later, it sold 25 offers, it sold for $175,000. I saw a piece on, I think it was 60 Minutes last night, where they were talking about Boise, Idaho, where the average price inflation over the last year is 31%. So as soon as I see things like that, I think about debt, because, housing is backed by mortgages, and that's a leveraged investment. So if you get any sort of pancaking of the price, suddenly a lot of people are underwater, and then there's debt associated with that, and you get this deleveraging, and that's terrible. So the question is how can we prevent that from happening? How can we at least go sideways like you're talking about, or maybe even go higher because the underlying E, so to speak, the economy is going higher? So I think that's really what it's all about, and getting to that is the answer to the problem.
And do you think we're there? Do you think that the economic progress we've seen in terms of the data for growth, inflation, whatever you want to call it, is there? I mean, does the fact that whether you say you have to pay $175,000 for an $115,000 house, or, you know, we've seen other anecdotes of, you know, I went to renew my lease on my Ford F-150 and I had to pay 25% more than the current asking price for the new one, or whatever thing you want to say. Isn't that, Ed, doesn't that represent economics? Do you think it represents economic strength of the demand, or do you think it represents weakness of the supply?
Well, let's put it this way, that it's unsustainable if it continues like that. And at some point, it prices people out because of inflation, whether that's consumer price inflation or house price inflation. That's bad. So what you want at a minimum is, you know, after the parabolic rise, you want it to stabilize. I saw a quote, by the way, this was from John Authors. It was Jeremy Grantham via John Authors. And this is what he said. He said, it's statistically simple to identify two sigma price moves. That is when the price moves two standard deviations out from their historical pattern. And all of them, every single one, went back to where they came from. All of them, every one. That's what Jeremy Grantham says. So what he's basically implying is when you get parabolic moves like we've seen, by the way, in Tesla, in Bitcoin, in cryptocurrencies, and the sorts of moves that we're starting to see, and even in house prices in places like Boise, Idaho, then you can't go sideways. It always goes down. What I'm saying is that to avoid a crash, maybe we can do what you say, which is get goose the E, and then we could go sideways. So we can go from 115 to 175 on that house in Iowa, go to 175 the next year, 175 the next year, and 175 the next year, and in that time period we grow into the price. That would be the Nirvana Goldilocks scenario. I'm not saying it's going to happen, or that Jeremy Grantham's wrong, that it has happened in the past. But the one way to do it is to have both wages and investment go up at the same time. So if you could get wages to go up, and actually I saw an article about this. It was very good. A guy by the name of Alex Williams was writing this post, who was talking about, here's the quote he actually had. He said, if we can be sure that the final consumer demand will be there to validate new investments, we should welcome the discovery of bottlenecks, because they let the economy know where to make investments. That's his point is, okay, get the consumer demand to be there. The consumer demand's there because wages are going up. We get the bottlenecks, which causes some level of inflation. But now companies know that the demand's there. The bottlenecks are there because the demand's there. And we know that it's not just a sugar high. It's actually supported by wages that are going up. And so they're going to make those investments, and a rolling stone gathers no moss, and voila. You know, we're off to the races.
Yeah,
that's my Nirvana.
Okay. So Ed, I want to trace this, how we get to the Nirvana, because, you know, I did an interview that airs on Wednesday with Marin Katusa, who's an investor in the commodity spaces. And he talked to me and he said, you know, silver is at what, $26, $27. That is Nirvana. I think he actually said that is Nirvana for silver miners who know what they're doing. If you're a greenfield producer and you can't even produce it at $40 per ounce, I mean, you have no chance. You should just go home. But if you're, you know, if you're a veteran producer, $26 is easy money. You could make it at 10, 15, whatever. So because of that, you're going to produce a ton of silver, or you're going to sell the silver that you've been, having in your coffers. And because of that, that's going to keep the price down. So Marin was warning silver bulls on saying, the price silver is going to skyrocket because there's going to be another short squeeze in silver, just like GameStop. He's saying, no, look, it's very easy for silver miners to produce silver, and they can do so at way less than $26 where the current price is. So they will. And I think it's the same thing. If houses are now selling for $175,000 that used to sell for $115,000 or $120,000, there's going to be a lot of building. Now, the thing is, it's going to take a while to build that supply. So in the medium run, that could be very good for the price of housing, right?
Right. I mean, so let's say, for instance, that, again, you go from 115 to 175, you stay there, you go up to 180 at some point, 185, you have a recession. Maybe at that point when you have the recession, you can have a garden variety recession, because actually you've now moved to a point where you're not in a bubble-like period. You're much more in a normal period. Interest rates have normalized. You know, house prices aren't going up tremendously. We've grown into the 37 times CAPE ratio. Now the CAPE has come down to 25 because, as you said, the E has gone up. That would be the Nirvana situation. Now, I would end all of this by saying that I don't believe it's going to happen, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm much more in the Jeremy Grantham camp that says that when you get two standard deviation moves, and by the way, that includes Bitcoin, just so that people know, Bitcoin is a two standard deviation move. Maybe the 40% or 50% down that we just had wipes that out. So now, you know, we're at an oversold level and we moved up to 40. Maybe, you know, we can get through, but I tend to think that, you know, when you get these two standard deviation moves, you have to take it off the table. You know, you pancake down, and unfortunately that means pain. So the best thing for regulators to do is to intervene before you get there. Take the punch bowl away before you get to the excess. But I think that we're already there, so there's going to be some level of pain in all probability, but I've laid out the case for how to prevent that, if at all possible.
And so when you say take the punch bowl away, that makes me think the Fed, it would be the Fed who takes the punch bowl away, whether it's tapering asset purchases on the, you know, on the full end of the yield curve, or it's just raising rates on the short end, or I don't know, for me, it would be over here, but for, I guess, the audience, it would be over here. The short end of the yield curve, raising rates. Do you think that, you know, the Fed will even ponder that, because we're not at the, you know, price stability, unemployment, we're really not where they want to be in terms of labor. So I don't know if you saw the editorial from the Bloomberg editorial board, but it said that the Fed should ponder raising rates. So that's what the Bloomberg editorial board thinks. What is the Real Vision editorial board, as represented by Ed Harrison, our managing editor? What is the Real Vision editorial board think?
Well, you know, I've always said my preference is probably to reverse what we have now, which used to be all monetary and no fiscal. Now we've gone from all monetary and no fiscal to all monetary plus all fiscal. I'd prefer to have, you know, slightly more fiscal and then, you know, tighter monetary. So if you think of it in terms of a paradigm of tight and loose in terms of monetary and fiscal, the old paradigm was loose monetary, tight fiscal. Now we're loose on both ends. My preference would be slightly looser on the fiscal side and then tighter on the monetary side. So that would mean jacking up rates more quickly, like the Bloomberg editorial says, but remaining, you know, adding stimulus on the fiscal side in order to promote wage growth, so that we can grow into the valuation.
Thanks, Ed. We're getting pretty close to ending the show. Let's take a few questions from the audience. So, Ed, I feel like I just asked you a personal question, which was a should question, a would question. What should the Fed do? What would the Fed do? But Andrew, he has a will question, which I think will questions are generally better. He asks, Ed, how likely is it that Bitcoin breaks down below $30,000?
Yeah, the $64,000 question at this point. You know, there are multiple levels that we would look at. 40, around 40 where we are now, which is the 200-day moving average. Then we have the 30 to 32 level, which is the support levels that most people are looking at and they're talking to. That's also the 50% Fibonacci retracement. The next level down from there is the 61.8 retracement, or 38.2, if you will, from, in terms of, you lost 61.2%. That's just below 25,000 on Bitcoin. And then I've seen people talk about support at the levels where we entered 2021 at the 20,000 level. So we're at 40, You know, 30 to 32 is where we bounced from. The next support level down to about 25, and then from there it's 20. So easily you could get yourself into, once you move beyond the 30 to 32, down to the Fibonacci retracement at 62% loss. And then, of course, you get into the dynamics of what does that mean in terms of diamond hands and all the rest of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, very interesting. And I want to ask you a question, which is, what do you think about the impact of the crypto market on the broader traditional capital markets of stocks, bonds, whatever? I understand you read an article today, which I want to, could you describe what that article said? And we can discuss it, because I've got a few thoughts.
Yeah, you know, I don't remember exactly how the article put it, but I think that the gist of the title was that the market shrugged off the crypto meltdown. And so what the article was saying is that even though crypto has become a really big space, it's not so big that what happens there is going to tip over into the broader market and therefore destabilize the broader market. And you can look at that positively or negatively, in the sense that, you know, if you're a crypto fan, then that's great, because it means that there's more room to grow for crypto. And it also means in general that you won't necessarily get a regulatory response. On the other hand, it means that crypto hasn't, you know, gotten enough oomph yet. Not enough people have moved over from the analog to the digital world for it to really, you know, there's still room to run. My personal view on all of that is that, yes, once you get to a certain level, I think the 50,000 level on Bitcoin, to the degree that Bitcoin's representative of the space, that's when the regulatory oversight starts to look interesting because of systemic issues. I think if you were to see a Bitcoin 100,000 before the end of the year, you probably would never even get there, because the regulatory oversight due to financial stability concerns would really become aggressive. And that's when the regulators would start to try to do something about it, just like the Chinese have started, and just like even the U.S. regulators have put a shot across the bow.
Yeah, I think that Rao was dead on when he called Bitcoin a black hole, because it sucks in all this capital from the real world. The question is, if you're a monetary authority from the real world, how do you react to a black hole? You're going to fight it. So I think that definitely is a threat that may not be priced into Bitcoin. Ed, I want to bring up a point, which is that from this article, that about $110 billion of money that went into Bitcoin was spent buying at an average cost of less than $36,000 per coin. And this is key, Ed, because there's a level at which the average person bought it. There's a level at which, you know, MicroStrategy, Michael Saylor bought it. There's a level at which Elon Musk bought it. And that's really, it shouldn't matter, but psychologically it does, because if you're above that level, you're making money. You're a crypto genius. And if you go below that level, uh-oh, you're not a crypto genius anymore, and you start having doubts. Not that I think, you know, Michael Saylor is ever close to having, you know, any doubts about his Bitcoin position, but I'm just saying, what do you think about this $36,000 per coin?
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that before we got off, because actually earlier this morning I saw that article and I wrote about it. I had like six tweets in a row about it. I think, let me see if I can find the tweet here. It was talking about a midweek report from blockchain analysis firm Chainalysis showed that over half of the $410 billion spent on acquiring current Bitcoin coin holdings occurred in the past 12 months. And they said about $110 billion of that was spent at an average cost less than $36,000 per coin. That means that the vast majority, you know, that's $300 billion was spent making a profit. They wouldn't have a profit if it were over 36,000. So when I talked about the 32 to 40,000 level, you know, between this sort of support level at 32 and the 200-day moving average at 40, where we are now, that's a very important level psychologically for people, because there are a lot of people who are either in the hole or not in the hole in that level. So it could be a tipping point. And ultimately, we passed the test the first time, the first go round, where we bounced off 31,000. But there's no guarantee that's going to happen the next time.
Yeah. That's a really good point. And I would add, just to answer Andrew's question, how likely is it that Bitcoin breaks down through $30,000? I would say, just on a mathematical basis, that if you treat Bitcoin like an individual stock, except a lot more volatile, which it kind of is, it is just simply more likely than not, and you could be super bullish or super bearish, that it will have a 33% correction, or I guess a 25% correction. I think those happens all the time. And you know, the number of stocks that don't have a 25% correction within 5 years is very, very, very small. Once you get something that's diversified, like S&P 500, you know, the odds of a drawdown are less so. And that's why people are so, you know, gung-ho about indexing. But I think, you know, regardless of my position on Bitcoin, I actually think that, you know, will a, you know, an 100 vol asset, because again, some people say it's a 65 vol asset. I think it's an 100 vol asset now, if you actually look at the updated things on like a 30-day traded thing. If you look at the Bitcoin VIX, basically, it's, I think, above 100 now. Like, the odds of that having a 25% correction is very high. So I think, regardless of whether I think Bitcoin's going to go to 1 million within a few years. Like, if I were a mathematically minded person, which, you know, I'm not an expert in mathematics, but I believe it to be the case that it is likely that it would go below net 30. That doesn't mean it will. I'd also add, Ed, that I think that Bitcoin, if you look at the 120-day correlation between Bitcoin's daily returns and the S&P 500, and I can post this on Twitter, it has been positively correlated above a correlation of 0.2 for over a year now. So I think that you're right that, you know, crypto absolutely dunked during weekend hours on yesterday, and you know, it staged a miraculous recovery, and the S&P 500, it didn't really seem to impact risk assets at all. I think you're absolutely right. Yesterday, on Wednesday, I might add, you know, the NASDAQ wasn't looking too pretty as we entered the morning. And I might add that Bitcoin really absolutely tanked right before the open. So I think that these assets are correlated. And I think that, you know, I mean, if I've got a chart, which I think you've seen before, like in 2018 and in 2019, it was accurate to say that Bitcoin is not correlated, but it's no longer accurate. We're in a different regime now. Now, we could exit and to a new regime, but I think that, you know, it has been correlated for over a year now. And I just think that, you know, it's kind of a fact.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, the more assets that are in the cryptocurrency space, the more regulators will look upon it. So correlation, more asset space, more regulatory risk. I continue to believe that. I know there are some other people who don't think that the regulatory risk is that big a deal, but I think that it's something to think about.
Yeah, brilliant. All right. Well, Ed, thanks so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yes. Thank you, Jack. Yeah.
And by the way, to the people at home, I would say, you know, thank you so much for watching. Stay tuned for Ash and Tony Greer TG Tuesday tomorrow. If you are a member watching on realvision.com, thank you so much for being a member. We really cherish your membership. If you are a YouTube subscriber watching on YouTube, please just like and smash that subscribe button and think about going to realvision.com. All right. Thanks so much, everyone.